Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com. And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. It's Brunch with Bernie. Just a quick update on what we're going to be talking about throughout the rest of the day. In our third hour, Governor Don Siegelman is going to join us. He, the victim of Karl Rove's dirty tricks and corruption of the Justice Department. Quite a story to tell. We've been among the first to lay this out, and it'll be great to have the governor back with us to give us an update. Also in our labor segment, Deborah Berger is going to be with us. She's the co-president of the California Nurses Association in our third hour. And in our second hour, Anything Goes Friday, your calls in our Geeky Science Rocks segment, which is one of my very favorites. But, of course, as I mentioned, it's Friday. So it is time for Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. I think of him as America's senator, and this is as America's national town hall with the U.S. Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, sanders.senate.gov. By the way, we've got a new chat room over at tomhartman.com. Check that out. But, Bernie, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. So I had a couple of questions. This whole thing with the budget. I know that you've met with Mr. Bernanke recently. You know, the bailouts and the state of the economy, and what happened with the budget. And apparently, Evan Bayh is blowing up Harry Reid's plans to get the budget passed.
Well, there's a lot that's going on, and it's going on within the context of the loss of 651,000 jobs in February. Unemployment rate going up to official unemployment rate going up to 8.1%, but I think most listeners know that those statistics do not include people who have given up looking for work or people who want to work full-time who are now working part-time. So, Tom, we are really in very, very rough economic shape, and it's imperative that we all put our heads together and do something to create the kind of jobs that we need to prevent us from slipping into a depression and getting us out of this very deep recession.
Yep.
Earlier in the week, we had in the Budget Committee, on which I serve, Ben Bernanke, who is the chairman of the Fed, came forward to give us his report, which he does on a periodical basis. And, you know, a lot of people, Tom, are very, very upset, including myself, about how this $700 billion TARP funds have been spent. I voted against both TARP proposals, but what people don't fully understand is the amount of money going to the financial institutions are not just this $700 billion, that in fact the Fed has lent out something like $2.2 trillion.
Yeah, and I understand with the guarantees it goes up to $8 trillion they've offered.
That's right.
Guarantees.
That is my understanding.
And that's half the GDP of the entire United States for an entire year.
Now, Tom, you would think – now – if you want to find out who received some of the TARP fund, you go to a website and you will find it.
Right.
You'll find all of the large financial institutions, the AIGs and the
right, because President Obama has decided to make that transparent.
Right. It's transparent. And you may get upset about it. You may get furious about it, as you should, but there it is. Now, if you want to find out where this $2.2 trillion went, that's three times as much as the TARP fund. You know what? You can't find it out.
Man.
So a couple of weeks ago, we wrote to Bernanke, and we said, dear Mr. Bernanke, please tell me. I'm a member of the United States Senate. My constituents, the American people, want to know where their taxpayer dollars are going. Well, we had a letter back saying, sorry, we're not going to tell you. So at this hearing, I said, again, please tell me who has received this money, what the terms are. How do you get the money? You know, a lot of people in Vermont would love this money. Is it 1-800-BEN? You know, you get some money.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it? And he would not tell us. So we have introduced legislation to bring transparency to at least that aspect of the Fed. And interestingly enough, I got a call from an old friend of mine who I disagree with on many, many, many issues, Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron is going to actually introduce or has introduced similar legislation in the House.
That's great.
So the goal here is simply to bring transparency to the Fed, because if the American people are going to put at risk $2 trillion, it seems to me at the very least They should know who's getting that money and how those decisions are made. So that's an issue that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, I went to the healthcare summit in the White House, and it seems to me that we have got to move very aggressively, and I was pleased that the president said, look, yeah, I understand that the times are tough, but that is not only a reason not to move forward on health care, that is a reason to move forward on health care,
mm-hmm.
because health care is not just a moral issue dealing with 46 million Americans who have zero health insurance, many more who are underinsured, but in fact it is an economic reason because you have General Motors spending more on health care per automobile than they do on steel. You have many small businesses in my state of Vermont, all over this country, who no longer are able to afford to provide health insurance for their workers or even for themselves. Cost of health care is soaring. So we've got to tackle this issue, and I applaud the president for wanting to do that. To my mind, it is pretty clear that we have got to move forward in several important ways. Number one, we have finally got to bite the bullet and do what every other major country on earth is doing and say that health care is a right of all Americans. Pure and simple. That's it. And I think we've got to get off of this employer-based health care concept, which originated in World War II for a specific set of reasons, and guarantee health care to all Americans. Number two, once you do that, once you throw everybody into the pot, the truth is you can run a simpler system, a more cost-effective system. You can do away with the hundreds of billions of dollars we're currently spending on billing, and where insurance companies are driving clients crazy because people thought they had coverage and they didn't have coverage and they had a pre-existing condition 28 years ago and they didn't read line 14, page 8, to know that they didn't have coverage. Comprehensive health care, free choice of doctors and hospitals. We can do it with a simple system, in my view, a state-administered single-payer system, and not spend any more than the enormous sum of money we are currently spending. Let's not forget that with 46 million uninsured, we end up today spending twice as much per person on healthcare than any other country because of the waste, the bureaucracy, the greediness, the profiteering that takes place within the system right now. I learned this week, Tom, interestingly enough, that some 15,000 doctors are supportive of a single-payer healthcare system. I think it should be administered at the statewide level, and that's where we want to go. Now, we have some good news in healthcare. It didn't make the front pages, but it is, to my mind, a big deal, that in the midst of the current healthcare crisis in general, there is a particular part of that crisis which is really, really bad, and that is primary healthcare. We have some 56 million Americans, including many with health insurance, who don't have a doctor, who don't have a dentist. And what everybody knows is that if people have a doctor to whom they can go when they get sick, what ends up happening is you don't end up in the emergency room. You don't end up in the hospital. You don't get sicker than you should have been because you get care when you need it. You can deal with some chronic problems, whether it's diabetes, whether it's obesity, whether it's drug problems, cigarettes, whatever. And it saves money. Well, I'm very happy to mention that in the stimulus package, President Obama supported our efforts to put $2 billion more into community health centers. Just a few days ago, he announced 126 new centers all over this country. They will provide not only primary health care on a sliding scale basis, dental care, mental health counseling, and the lowest cost prescription drugs in America. We also tripled the funding for the National Health Service Corps, which means that we can forgive the debts of young graduates of medical school who want to serve in primary care and in underserved areas. So that's a big
deal.
That's
wonderful.
It is. It is a major step forward. And I just spoke to the president the other day very briefly, who said that community health centers are a priority for him. So we introduced legislation which has a lot of support in the Senate. Congressman Jim Clyburn introduced legislation in the House, a lot of support there. I think we're going to quadruple the number of community health centers. And the goal here is to make sure that every American has a doctor of his or her own. It is a huge deal. Cut health care costs, keep our people healthier, do more work on prevention, and at the end of the day, as I said, we are going to save money. So we're excited about that. We're making some progress, obviously a long way to go. In the stimulus package and in the state of Vermont, we are making progress in terms of energy efficiency and sustainable energy. I was recently appointed the chair of the Green Jobs Subcommittee on the Environmental Committee, and we're going to work very, very hard And if any listeners out there have any thoughts on this issue about how we can, over a period of years, create millions of good-paying jobs as we move away from a fossil fuel, as we make our country independent of foreign oil, as we move to energy efficiency, wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, etc. It's a big deal, and we're working on that as well.
And people can get back with you over at sanders.senate.gov.
Absolutely. Love to hear from them.
Great place to contact Bernie. 503-796-2324, our telephone number for international calls. If you're within the United States, toll-free 866-987-TOM. 866-987-THOM. Our lines are full. Calls for Bernie Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders, up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. Don't think so. Not a chance. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall. Bernie taking your calls, your questions. Ready to go, Bernie?
Let's do it.
Okay. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders. Rich, you're on the air. We've got a pot shop here. There we go. Now we can hear you, Rich. Go.
Two ideas I'd like to get your thoughts on. At the end of World War II, we had a Marshall Plan for rebuilding Western Europe, and we also rebuilt Japan. We're spending hundreds of billions to improve the lives of Iraqis and Afghanis. But when we come up with what is essentially a Marshall Plan for the U.S., there's stiff resistance. I think the stimulus plan should be sold as a Marshall Plan for the U.S. And also, when they bring up the redistribution of wealth, when we return the tax rates on the wealthy to the Reagan era, we need to challenge them on this and ask them if it was redistribution of wealth when Reagan did it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks,
Rich. Well, I think Rich is right on both counts. This country, as we all know, is facing an enormously serious economic crisis. And at the same time, because of 8 years of do-nothing Bush policies and of neglect for many years, our infrastructure is crumbling. This is not a secret. Everybody in America who owns a car knows that our roads and our bridges are in bad shape. Talk to your city manager, your mayor, and you'll find out your water systems need, in many cases, repair. Wastewater plants need repair. So right now, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, I believe we have over $1 trillion of unmet infrastructure needs. So as the caller indicated, this is, in a sense, a Marshall Plan of pouring tens and tens of billions of dollars to put people to work rebuilding our infrastructure, our schools, making us a stronger country in the process, and that makes eminent sense to me. And I think this plan is a good idea. Is it perfect? No. But it is a good, important step forward, and we hope it will create 3 to 4 million jobs in the next 2 years. Second of all, this country, after decades and decades, going back to Richard Nixon, maybe before that, we were talking about breaking our dependency on foreign oil. This is a geopolitical issue. This is how we get into wars like in Iraq, because we're fighting for oil. Wouldn't it be a good day if we can produce the energy that we need in America, and we can go a major step forward in doing that? If we invest in energy efficiency, we waste enormous amounts of energy. My state of Vermont does a good job in energy efficiency. California does a good job. If other states did what we are doing, we could cut energy use substantially just doing that. And Vermont, California can do a lot better than we are doing. If we moved forward in sustainable energy, we are just beginning to see the potential of photovoltaics, of solar thermal plants, which we should be building, of wind, both small wind turbines and larger wind projects, of biomass. There's huge potential out there, and we create millions of jobs doing that. Wouldn't it be a nice day if we started to open up some of those shutdown factories in America and we started producing wind turbines here in the United States, photovoltaic panels here in the United States, and other sustainable energy technologies here in the United States and creating jobs. So I think Rich is absolutely right that we should look at this as a Marshall Plan, rebuilding this country and putting people to work. And we should challenge anyone who disagrees with us. In terms of taxes, the United States has today the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. And while under Bush, the middle class shrank, his main goal in life was to give tax breaks to the very, very wealthy. So I think we should be saying that we need a fairer, more progressive tax system. Under Dwight David Eisenhower, I believe the highest rates in America were 91% or something like that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom.
That's right. No, it was 91% from 1936 until Reagan. Well, until LBJ dropped it down to 74% in 64, and then Reagan took it down to 27, 28, 29, whatever it was. Yeah.
And you know what? Under Eisenhower, the economy did pretty well.
That's right.
Pretty well. And I think ultimately, to take Rich's point a step further, we have got to deal with the culture of greed. I think the American people are just furious about what Wall Street did to America, how the greed of a small number of CEOs, not content with 20 or 30% rates of return, not content with only making $40 million a year, they needed $100 million, they needed $1 billion, and then they start pushing worthless paper and derivatives out on the market and combining that with other loans. And leading us to where we are today. So I think we have to tackle this culture of greed. I think we need a new Wall Street whose job is not short-term fabulous gains, but stability and making sure that businesses in America, homeowners have the loans that they need. So, you know, those are some of the areas I think we've got to focus on.
Pretty straightforward stuff. Joanne in Los Angeles, we have a half a minute here before the break. Joanne, if you want to just toss a quick question out.
Yes, I have a question about the new ESTA program by Homeland Security. What it's hailed as is this easy process for foreign travelers to be pre-approved to come to the United States, but what I'm finding from a friend of mine who's currently stuck in the UK is that your application gets stuck in limbo.
Okay. We'll give Bernie a chance to respond to that after the break when we come right back about the new ESTA program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls at 866-987-THOM, 987-8466. Our number for out-of-the-country callers, 503-796-2324, tomhartman.com, our website, Bernie's is sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Conservatives, go ahead and make my day. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, sanders.senate.gov, his website, answering your questions. And Bernie, the last caller had a question about the ESTA program. I'm not familiar with that program. So
I'm not all that familiar with it either, Tom. But the problem is, obviously, you want to make sure that people who come into this country are not coming in here to do us harm. So you need to investigate that. On the other hand, what we know is there have been many instances where there have been long, long bureaucratic delays. So I think we want to expedite the process of people who are coming into this country to study, to work, or whatever, are able to get in a timely manner. That's the challenge that we face.
Yeah. Amen. Jim in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, it's a privilege. Thank you, Tom and Bernie. I just want to ask Bernie if there isn't some way that we could get rid of free trade and get into fair trade. I think we have to incentivize companies to stay in this country and hire American citizens. And I'm just wondering what's being done on this now, if anything.
Okay. Jim, thank you very much. That's a very important issue. It's an issue that Tom and I have discussed quite often over the years. And I think it is something that we have got to address. Manufacturing in America, even before the current economic crisis, has declined precipitously. I think in the last 5 or 6 years, we've lost probably 25-30% of our manufacturing jobs, and those are good-paying jobs. So we're losing good-paying jobs. The jobs are being replaced by low-paying Walmart jobs, and that's not the way you sustain a middle class. One of the reasons is, in my view, our disastrous trade policy. That's NAFTA, that's Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China. And these are trade policies that were negotiated and pushed by large multinational corporations, frankly, with the goal of throwing American workers out on the street so you don't have to pay a worker $12, $15, $20 an hour, health care, environmental protection. You move to China, pay people there 50 cents an hour, bring the product back into America. The Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, all the big money corporate interests love free trade. Bill Clinton supported those concepts, I think, absolutely incorrectly. George Bush, John McCain, hot to trot for all of that stuff. So we have to revisit that in a big way. Trade is a good thing, but it is ultimately not fair to American workers to force them to compete with people who make pennies an hour. That is not fair. It is not right. Now, I will tell Jim something that we did accomplish within the stimulus package. It's an interesting proposal that an amendment that I offered, which passed with Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, whose views on many issues are different than mine, but on this one, we came together. And here's what the issue was. In the financial institutions, within the last year, about 100,000 American workers have been laid off. Everybody knows that these institutions are reeling. They're laying off people. 100,000 American workers. Well, it turns out that some of these financial institutions are applying for what is called an H-1B visa. This is a guest worker program that enables them to bring foreign workers into this country to work in financial institutions. What we said and what passed in its law now is that financial institutions and other institutions, companies that receive TARP funding may not replace laid-off American workers with foreign workers. So we think that if American workers are paying for the bailout of these institutions, they shouldn't have to be replaced by foreign workers. That was passed. And I should tell you that the business community, the financial institutions, are not happy about that.
Yeah. Usha, or is it Usha, in Edina, Minnesota. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, actually, I was calling about single-payer health care, and you've been talking about it, Tom, for, I guess, over the last week or maybe
Last 7 years.
No, I know, but late. And you had somebody from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I worship you, so I'm not trying to be rude or anything, but I think you need to go to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation website and actually look at what they are proposing, and they really back not single payer.
Usha, I know, and thank you very much for the call and the commentary. Bernie was not part of that program, and Bernie, your thoughts on healthcare?
Usha, I believe that our current system is the most wasteful and bureaucratic in the entire world. I think the problem is not that we're not spending enough money, but that you're seeing insurance companies taking, I believe, about 20% of every healthcare dollars for their administration, for their profiteering, for their advertising. I think, and we'll be introducing legislation, I should say, along with my colleague Jim McDermott in the House, which would provide state-administered, not federally administered, but state-administered single-payer system. And, Usha, what I can say is that I'm not familiar with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and they're very good people, but they have to say on this. But I have seen a number of studies which say that we can provide health care to all Americans, quality care, freedom of choice, without spending any more than we're currently spending. So I do support a state-administered single-payer.
Bernie, after you mentioned that last week, we had a number of callers say, wait a minute, when we had purely state-administered educational programs, poor states like West Virginia ended up with crummy schools, and rich states like New York ended up with good schools. Wouldn't it be the same way with health care? And I said, well, I'm assuming that Bernie would have some federal dollars in there to equalize those income maladjustments. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. What you want to do, obviously, if you're talking about a state-administered, it's all states are going to have the system. We're going to give states some flexibility, you know, because the state of South Carolina is not the state of California, is not the state of Vermont. So you don't want to have every state, doing things exactly the same way. And some states can learn from other states, give people and states the ability to innovate. But everybody would have a minimum comprehensive package.
Yeah, there you go. Doug in Humboldt, California. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom, glad to have you back. And it's Humboldt, California.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, my question for Senator Sanders is that since you brought up that H-2B visa, there's been reported that there's since 2006, there's been up to from 23 guest worker programs up from nine that brought in 5 million and 23 that brought in 10.6 million. What is being done to reduce that foreign worker level?
Well, I don't, Doug, the H-1B and the H-2B don't bring in that kind of numbers. It's smaller than that. There's also other guest worker programs, H-1A and agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. But as I just indicated a moment ago, Senator Grassley and I passed legislation, I think for the first time, which begins to put limitations on the H-1B, which is for professional workers. H-2B is for more blue-collar type workers. I believe that there is abuse in the system. I believe that many American employers are bringing foreign workers into this country not because they can't find American workers who are prepared to do that work. We have heard situations, for example, where they're trying to bring in welders into the United States. Well, I think last I heard, we have plenty of people in this country who can weld. H-2B trying to bring lifeguards. That I loved. Lifeguards into the United States. Tom, when you and I were kids, everybody wanted to be a lifeguard and look at the pretty girls, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're trying to bring right. ski instructors into the United States. You know,
it's bizarre.
It is bizarre, and it's an abuse of the program. So to answer Doug's question, we are taking a leading role. We're working with some of the unions on this issue. We've made a little bit of progress, but we're gonna take a hard look at that whole issue. In my view, there is abuse in the H-1B, is abuse in the H-2B. The goal of these programs is to say, okay, after an exhaustive search, if you cannot find an American worker who can do a particular job, you can go abroad. That's fair enough. But I suspect that in many instances, they are not doing a serious search, and they're going abroad for cheaper labor.
Yeah. Steve in Detroit, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Good afternoon, Senator. My name is Steve. I'm calling from Detroit. I have a question, and it goes to these memos that were released from the Justice Department on Monday. And this goes to how we have a media complicit and a propaganda machine explicitly lying this nation into war. That memo gave Bush the power, and I watched the White House press corps decimated for the past 6 years, and I watched this pounding of what was called liberal media. And is this purposeful? Is this something that needs to be investigated?
Well, Steve, the answer is yes. I think there are millions of Americans who believe that a number of actions on the part of the Bush administration were illegal, were unconstitutional. And I do believe that you have to look at it not from a vengeful point of view, but to make sure that what Bush did does not become a precedent for future presidents. Everybody in this country has got to obey the law, even if you're the president of the United States. On the other hand, while we do that, we have to understand that most Americans today are worried about whether they're going to have a job, whether they're going to have health care, whether their kids are going to go to college, what happens when you lose your savings when the stock market goes down. So I don't want to suspend the activities of government and just focus on what Bush did. But I think you cannot ignore it, and it has to be investigated.
Yeah. Keith Olbermann last night had a constitutional scholar on pointing out that during about an 8-year period, as a consequence of these memos, we actually had a dictatorship in the United States. Thank God they never actually exercised the powers they were claiming, or they did so in a very limited fashion. But it's just really, these memos are startling. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us taking your calls. Sanders.Senate.gov, by the way, Bernie's website. Ours is TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this brief moment to stimulate the economy. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
what you're thinking. There are some things you can't hide. I wanna know what you're feeling. Tell me what's on your mind.
Yep, Real Talk Radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from Senator Bernie Sanders today. Our Brunch with Bernie hour, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Ours is tomhartman.com. Jim in Berkeley, California. Jim, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
I'm going to apologize up front for my laryngitis. I'm just really wondering, something you mentioned at the top of the hour, Evan Bayh and presumably a bunch of other so-called centrist Democrats threatening to torpedo Obama's budget, and in general, Harry Reid and the filibuster, you mentioned something at the beginning of the week about apparently Reid can't force a traditional filibuster. That's not entirely true. That article in Huffington Post was made a little bit more of it than really was the case. But the bottom line question is, what do we do about these folks? How can we stop the obstruction, not only of the Republicans, but of the of some of the Senate Democrats.
Well,
and how do we get Harry Reid to stand up?
Yes, exactly.
Well, Harry Reid has, as I've said many times, a tough job. He has 58, and hopefully Al Franken will be 59, independent people who sometimes go their own way. And I think that that's unfortunate, but that is the reality. I think ultimately the long-term solution to this problem is for a very, very strong grassroots movement demanding that this country and the president move forward in a progressive way. People do not appreciate just the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that are thrown at Congress from all of the big money interests, from the special interests, people's fears about 30-second ads if you vote this way and that way. And we have got to develop that kind of strong grassroots movement that gives courage or puts in new people who are prepared to stand with working families in this country and take on the big money interest. That's what we have to do. I wanted to mention, by the way, Tom, over the years, you and I have heard many people calling in and say they're sick and tired of paying 25-30% interest rates on their credit cards. Hear that quite often. I did want to mention that shortly, we're working on the final details of this, we are going to introduce a national usury law.
Whoa. Congratulations.
Which will prohibit any financial institution from charging outrageous rates. We think the time is right to do that. We think people are just disgusted with what goes on with the credit card companies, especially these banks that we're bailing out and you're getting charged 25-30% interest rates. So in the very near future, we will be introducing legislation to accomplish that goal.
That is great. It is they're loan sharks. They've become loan sharks.
They are loan sharks. That is exactly they got three-piece suits on. But they're not much different than these guys who, you know, break people's kneecaps when they don't pay their rates.
Yeah. Woody in Litchfield, Arkansas. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders. Woody?
Yes.
You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Nice to talk to you again, Tom, and Senator Sanders. Today I wanted to talk about my 31 years of government service with various agencies and the lack of GAO enforcement. We now have internal control officers who report to state directors. I had submitted a case to the Office of Inspector General and was responded that it had to take the state director's interest to get this. Well, this was the guy that's responsible for the loan programs. To then go to OIG, I'm a real estate appraiser, and the concerns that I had. And, again, GAO, when I first started in 77, right after the Nixon debacle, was quite high, and it slipped away over the years.
Well, Woody, let me say this. I think most listeners and most Americans know that among many of their other attributes, the Bush administration was probably the most incompetent administration, certainly in modern history, if not in the history of this country. They did not want the government agencies to enforce the law. They didn't want to take on special interest. They cut back on staffing for important agencies that were designed to protect consumers. I hope and expect that under the Obama administration, you're going to see a lot more aggressive enforcement to make sure that government protects the people that it's supposed to protect and not those people simply want to make a buck off of government. So let's hope a new day is coming in that whole area, and I suspect that it will be.
Frank in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator, I wish you'd introduce some legislation to prevent the government from privatizing itself and outsourcing jobs like the Bush administration outsourced the printing of American passports. I think it was in Thailand. They outsourced the intelligence agency. When the government does it, they do it a lot cheaper. They get rid of the middleman. And when the government spends money, I think it generates about $3 into the economy. So I don't understand what the benefit is by privatizing the government when it's making their friends rich. The people that
Under the Bush administration, that was the benefit. That's why they did it. The goal was not to get efficient, effective efforts. The goal was to privatize so that you could have corporate interest paying lower wages, cutting back on benefits, and making profits by doing work that, in many cases, government workers should be doing. The Bush people wanted to make massive privatizations. They did far too many. We stopped them in some instances. But Frank is absolutely right. This is a whole issue that we have to look at. In my view, and I say this as a former mayor, at the end of the day, I think the taxpayers get best value when you have serious public employees who take their jobs seriously, where you don't have a lot of turnover, where people are dedicated to their work. I think that's when the taxpayer does best. So I appreciate Frank's comments and agree with him.
Bernie, we have 30 seconds left before we have to wrap up this hour. What do you see coming up in the Senate in the next week?
Well, we're going to have to pass this budget. I think that vote will be on Monday night or Tuesday night. We're moving to an energy bill, which will be a big, big deal. The money for the stimulus package is now getting out to states, cities, and towns, and it's absolutely picking up on Frank's point and Woody's point before that. It's absolutely imperative that that money be spent effectively and creates the kind of jobs to rebuild America that we've got to do.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders, one of my personal heroes, and the senator from the great state of Vermont, taking your calls. Our Brunch with Bernie. Our Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank
you. Check out Bernie's, thank you, Bernie. And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. Anything Goes Friday, coming up next. Your calls on whatever you'd like to talk about.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. An awful lot going on these days, or today in general. Newt Gingrich says he is seriously considering running for president of the United States. I can just see the ads now. As Newt is giving his wife, as she recovers from cancer treatment, surgery, dying from cancer, as she's recovering from surgery in the hospital room, he walks up to her as she comes out of the haze, out of the fog from the anesthesia, and says, "Sweetie, here's your divorce papers." How can this guy even think he's going to run for president? He used to be my congressman, and you know, this was when I lived in the northern suburbs of Atlanta, and even in that right-wing, I lack the words, area, he was highly unpopular. It just kind of blows my mind. U.S. unemployment rate, by the way, has jumped to 8.1% in February. This is the worst it's been since 1983, which, by coincidence, was a year and a half after Ronald Reagan began the destruction of the American middle class and the destruction of the U.S. tax system. That's when the stock market first really crashed in a big way and unemployment really started spiking in a really big way. Barack Obama is going to Columbus, Ohio today, by the way. He's going to give a speech to a group which includes 25 new police officers brought back on the job because Columbus, Ohio had to lay off people. And now as a result of the federal stimulus money, he's able to put people back on the job. So I think that's a great thing. So, you know, we'll see how this all shakes out. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced yesterday that Iran is going to be invited to a major conference on Afghanistan. I think this is a great step in the right direction. Let's bring people in from the cold. Let's try to make them more rational parts of the community of nations. And, you know, you got to give them a chance. And by the way, the polar ice, the Arctic region of the planet is warming up so quickly. You'll recall 4 or 5 years ago, they were saying, you know, maybe by the end of the century, as in 2100, 2099, there'll be no more polar ice. You'll have an open North Pole and you can run ships across there and stuff. Looks like now the year that it's going to be completely open, 2013. This is downright scary stuff. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and our special number for folks calling from outside the United States, 503-796-2324. By the way, these phone numbers are on our website at tomhartman.com if you want to check it out. Chris in Abiquiu. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Oh, not much, Tom. Thanks for the anything goes. Just an idle thought. Have you ever come across, or are you familiar at all, with the term Lucretiist?
No, I have not.
It's from the Latin lucre, for riches or profits, and the reference is to people whose only real god is money.
So it'd be L-U-C-R-E theist.
L-U-C-R-E theist, yeah. They may claim Christianity or Islam or to be Jewish, but they only really worship monetary gain, basically. My father used to use the term, and I know that he got it from Woody Guthrie. Apparently, it's an old union slang term that came out of the IWW, but I just thought it was very apropos for the people that we're dealing with today, the Limbaughs and whatnot, the Lucretheists, who only really worship money and the hell with anything else.
Yeah, you're right. I just hit Google with it. There's not a single response for it.
There's not a thing on Google. I have an old poster, an old union IWW poster that has Teach the Lucretheists a Lesson printed on it. But that's the only other reference I can find. I was just wondering if you knew, because if anybody would, you would.
Yeah, no, I don't. But thank you for educating me, Chris.
Fair enough, man.
I'm telling you, we've got the – and thanks a lot for the call. We've got the smartest listeners on earth in this show. I am honored to spend the day, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week with all of you every single day. Jim in Sonora, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm a self-employed tax preparer for over 25 years, and one of the things I've always faced with is my clients coming in and they switch from being employees to being self-employed, and I got to tell them they're going to pay self-employment tax at 14.1% of their business net.
Yeah, let me tell you about it.
Yeah, I know, and as it started with Reagan and the law I signed on April 20th, 1983, where he raised it, I think it was 9.35% for us self-employed people that time up to 14.1%, and it's just really onerous on society. And in general, I think, because it really prohibits entrepreneurship. And I give a good example of, let's say a 25-year-old starts out making $40,000 a year for 40 years as an employee. He pays $122,000 for the self-employment tax of regular Social Security taxes. And if he was self-employed, he'd pay $225,000, $103,000 more in 40 years. And his retirement check is going to be exactly the same from Social Security as an employee.
Yeah, because the rationale behind this, of course, is that that when you're self-employed, you are both the employer and the employee. So you're picking up both the employee and the employer's portion of the Social Security tax. And that's a nice rationale, but you're absolutely right. It does discourage people from, doing one-man shop kind of things.
Right. And also another thing I wanted to mention, I think the NAFC is on this too, is that we should have the self-employed health insurance deduction as a line item on the Schedule C versus on page one. Myself personally, I pay $307 a month worth of health insurance, so this would save me over $500 worth of,
Now, isn't a simple way around both of these things to simply create a sub-S corporation and then have, a tax preparing service, a bank or whatever, to pay yourself out of your own corporation and to pay your income tax out of the corporation?
Well, you could. The thing is that many of my clients are in sort of that. I usually have a cutoff line. I say you got to be a $40,000 or $50,000 net at least before you think about even incorporating.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of people who are like $20,000 to $40,000 nets. So I just really said, cost-wise, I just said, well, you got to spend $800 for franchise fees in the state of California. You got to pay me $200 or $300 to do your corporate tax returns. There's another $1,100 you got to fork out right there.
Yeah.
So,
whereas here in Oregon, it's a $10 is the minimum corporate tax, and it's a and. You know, it's there are services, you know, LegalZoom and whatnot, where you can get a corporation, a sub-S corporation, set up fairly cheap. Well, $300 is probably about average, actually.
Right.
But, yeah, good point.
Do you think there's any chance we could roll this back to what it was before Reagan signed the law? 9.35 was the self-employment tax at that rate. Do you think there's anything we could do about it?
Well, the problem is that the self-employment tax at that time reflected the combination of the two FICAs. What people don't get, the employer and employee, what people don't get is that the big change that Reagan made with the Greenspan Commission was that prior to 83, all Social Security payments that came in were current workers. All Social Security payments that went out were to retired workers and to the full third of Social Security recipients, who are literally the disabled, the widows, the orphans, the widowers, you know, those people who just have nothing, you know, who have fallen into that social safety net. So it's really not just a retirement program. Only about two-thirds of it is for people who are retired. But in any case, that it was from its founding until 83, it was always that the current workers are paying for the retirement of their parents' generation.
Correct.
And starting in 83 and ending presumably around 2015, 2020 at the most, but this is time limited. One generation, the boomer generation, one generation is being double taxed, and that they're not only paying for the retirement of their parents and grandparents, but they are also putting money into what's called the Social Security Trust Fund, which was created in 83, never existed before, a savings account, so that they are paying for their own retirement as well as for the retirement of their elders. And then when they finally die off in the 2020s, then it's presumably going to go back. The Social Security Trust Fund is supposed to liquidate itself, and we're going to go back to a system where the current workers are paying for the retired workers. And the rationale for doing this was that the boomer generation was such a statistical anomaly. There were so many, you know, people born after, so many babies born right after World War II, that it was like the rabbit going through the python, and this was the way to deal with it. And I don't think most boomers realize that they're being double taxed, and also they don't realize how disingenuous the Republicans are when they go, oh, the Social Security Trust Fund's going to go away in 2024. Well, it's supposed to. I mean, that was the whole point of it. But you know, the problem is that because everybody went along with this, you know, I mean, the Democrats voted for it, although, you know, many opposed it because it was an increase in tax on working people. But Reagan and the Republicans pushed this thing through. Self-employment tax is basically just the combination of the employee and employer portion. And frankly, if you want to knock down that tax, the way you do it is you do away with the $100,000 cap.
So
Bill Gates starts paying the same percentage of his income, and not to pick on Bill Gates, but, you know, anybody who's got an income over $100,000 a year pays the same percentage of their income in as somebody who makes under $100,000 a year. And then, presumably, you know, A, you could use that to pay for, you know, a good Medicare for All system as well as the Social Security. Or if you just did that for Social Security, you could drop that Social Security tax rate considerably and break out the Medicare for All, you know, kind of thing, national health care program separately. But, Jim, you raise an excellent point, and I thank you very much for calling and bringing it up. Back to your calls right after this. Tom Hartman here with you, TomHartman.com, our website, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, 503-796-2324, our alternate line. We'll be right back. Conservatives and outside the country.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, your radio support group for We the People. And breaking news, maybe broken news, I'm not sure. Breaking news, yes. from the wire services. In remarks that seem guaranteed to create controversy, conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh said today that he was rooting for the planet Earth to explode because it would help the GOP retake the White House. Mr. Limbaugh elaborated on his planet explosion theory, explaining that if the world blows up in the next 4 years, it will happen on Barack Obama's watch. Let's face it, the world exploding would be great for the GOP, and Barack Obama knows it, he said. That's why he's doing everything in his power, Obama said about Limbaugh, Limbaugh said about Obama, to keep the planet from blowing up. While asserting that he had his fingers crossed that the planet would detonate sometime in the next 4 years, Limbaugh said that there were other scenarios he found equally appealing. If the population of the U.S., he said, was suddenly afflicted with plagues, locusts, and open sores, that would be fantastic for the Republican Party. I'm rooting for all of those things to happen. In an appearance on CNN, RNC Chairman Michael Steele seemed to distance himself somewhat from the $400 million man's remarks, telling Wolf Blitzer, Rush is a great entertainer who just wants to make people laugh like Bobby Jindal. Hedging a little, Mr. Steele insisted that despite perceived differences, he and Mr. Limbaugh are on the same page. Rush is rooting for me to fail, and in fact, I am failing, said Mr. Steele. Yes, our cheesy news for the day. Actually, our Borowitz news for the day. And tip of the hat, and many thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for that. Our telephone number, 866-987-THOM. And Bruce in Chehalis, Washington. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Tom, I have a good morning. I have a six-page document in my hand that's very troubling. The title is United States Gives China Eminent Domain Over U.S. Property. The subtitle is Beyond High Treason. And the allegation of the document is that Secretary of State Clinton cut a deal with the Chinese on her trip there 2 weeks ago to get them to buy more of our debt. Now, the author of this article claims that he called the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, and they confirmed this as fact. Is there any way that you can investigate this? I'm in shock over this this title.
What, you know, sometimes it's possible to take something and characterize it as something else. If somebody is holding the debt of the U.S., I mean, here's how you could stretch the logic of this to the point where it would kind of snap in your face, but it would be actually true. If the Chinese are holding treasury notes, and if the government, our government, were to default, they may have some recourse of some way to claim U.S. government property to say, you know, if you're not going to return our money to us, we're going to take some of your property. You know, I don't know the details of how that would happen, but, you know, there's a certain logic to that. They're holding our debt. Now, that involves two huge ifs, or at least one huge if, and that is that the U.S. government would default. It ain't going to happen. But if that, you know, if somebody were trying to pursue that logic path, they could make that kind of case and make it sound all scary when actually there's nothing there. But I would say just because something's on the Internet doesn't mean it's real. But I'll tell you what, post it over on the homepage at TomHartmann.com on the blog for today's show. I'll read that this afternoon, or actually I'll probably read it tomorrow. This afternoon I'm going to be on a train to Seattle, and I'll see what I can learn about it. Okay.
Okay, Tom. Thanks. If I find out any more, I'll call you.
Thanks a lot, Bruce. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's time to flush Rush.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
But in my
By the way, just a note. In the inside radio publications, the within the radio industry stuff that I get. You know, I get these daily newsletters that are for people within the radio industry. Best guess is that Rush's ratings have just about doubled in the last few weeks, and as a result of that, he's probably going to be worth at least $100 million more than he is right now. This guy who just, you know, recently, what was it, last year, signed a $400 million contract is now worth $500 million. It's mind-boggling. I mean, I got to figure out some way to if I was, you know, I'm not going to do this. I don't do that kind of stunt or that kind of radio, frankly. But if Newt Gingrich were to attack me by name, boy, would that, you know. Anyway.
Well, the Rush looks so unhealthy, physically unhealthy.
Yeah. He looked hopped up to me.
Yeah, I don't know about that guy. But I'd like to, in my efforts of slow climate change, I'd like to tell you about an idea I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trucks, they have these wind fairings that sort of cut the wind so it doesn't hit the back of the van.
Yeah.
And so my idea, because there's such a massive area, and a lot of these trucks that travel around, they have cabs in the back of them where they have the guys sleep overnight at truck stops, and they have like flat screen TVs, LED lights, computers, and it's actually very comfortable for them back there.
Yeah.
And it's my belief that these large fairings, these large wind truck wind fairings, can be covered with flexible solar panels, because there's companies like NanoSolar, NanoSolar.com, and there's others. If you go to Google and put in the words flexible solar panels, a lot of they can be laminated to these wind fairings, and so this would be truck, and then they can have like batteries. There's a company called HiMotion, HyMotion, HiMotion. They make lithium-ion batteries, so they can store the juice from the.
That's a great suggestion, Harvey, and something that actually probably over the long term we should be thinking about for cars as well, and we should sell for people for their garages and for their carports. We need to be thinking about shingles for houses made out of solar panels, where when the roofer comes out and they replace the roof, I mean, they turn the entire roof into a giant solar panel. I mean, there's so many potentials, so many different ways to go with this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And happy birthday to my sweetie, Louise. Today is her birthday. No, I'm not going to tell you how old she is. She's having a wonderful, hopefully she's having a wonderful birthday. Here she is. Yeah, it's a certain anniversary of her 25th birthday. Let's leave it at that. 866, I'm getting the evil eye, 987-THOM is our telephone number. And Richard in Orlando. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Shabbat Shalom, Tom. How are you?
Hey, Shabbat Shalom, Richard. Are you going to be in Germany in a couple of weeks?
Unfortunately, I'm not. You know, it's not going to happen, but maybe next time.
Ah, okay. I just realize you're this is a long story, but there's a small group of us who work with Salem International. The SalemInternational.org is the website, this international relief organization who get together once a year in Germany. And I will be there in 3 weeks. And, Richard, you were there the last couple of years. I've seen you there.
Yeah, yeah, I lived there for a while, but not this time. You got to miss out sometimes, I guess.
So, yeah, saying every Friday we've got a little round robin. So, anyhow, what's up, Richard?
Hey, I was wondering about taxes in this case. You know, during the last election, we heard a lot about, for example, a lot of the right and left going back and forth between taxes and statistics like, you know, the bottom 50% don't even pay taxes, or the top half of 1% don't pay more than that anyway. So my question is, flat tax. Has that ever been tried? And what I mean by that is, you know, where every single dollar, regardless of how much you make, is taxed, because wouldn't that make it to where everyone could pay less on each dollar?
Well, that's the theory, and that's how it's promoted by generally rich people like Steve Forbes. Steve Forbes has been all over the flat tax for years.
And the
bottom line is that median income in the United States is $47,000 and change. That's, what the 50th percentile of workers make. And when you get into below the 40th percentile, which is a large chunk of workers, people are making so little that they're paying virtually no income tax at all. And a flat tax would dramatically increase the tax on the income tax on working people. The fact of the matter is that here's the problem, Richard. They're always trying to push this for the income tax. Let's say somebody makes $25,000 a year and they've got a couple of kids. They're paying no income tax at all, right? Because of how much money they're making or how little money they're making. But they are paying They are paying FICA tax. They are paying Social Security tax. They're paying a Medicare tax. They're paying property taxes. They're paying sales tax. They may be paying a state income tax. They're paying all kinds of different taxes. And somebody making millions of dollars a year, they may have a zillion loopholes to get out of paying income taxes. And those other taxes that I just mentioned are such a relatively small portion of their income. Like FICA taxes, for example, the payroll tax. If you make over $100,000, you don't pay a penny of that tax after $100,000. So somebody who makes $1 million a year is on $900,000 of that $1 million a year. They're not paying a penny of FICA tax, of payroll tax. And those are the guys who are saying, well, let's keep that way. But on the income tax, let's make sure that somebody making $25,000 a year is paying the same amount that I'm paying. You know, somebody's making $1 million. So it's a scam, basically, is the bottom line. It becomes very regressive.
Yeah, I guess it's not possible.
No, it's just not a good idea. And it is, frankly, what we see with the Social Security tax. And although it's even worse than that because it cuts off at $100,000. But, Richard, thanks for the call. And
very much, Tom. Take care.
Good talking to you. And look forward to seeing you again one of these days soon. Rob in Pasadena. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Great show today. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the State of the Union. You know, I read in these headlines that we've got you know, healthcare is in the tank, the financial system's going down, automobiles or auto companies are in trouble, insurance companies, you know, and I'm thinking, is there a narrative? Is there a line that connects this stuff? And what I come up with is the corporate structure.
Yep.
I mean, all of these are corporations. All of them have a mandate for profits, and we're socializing losses. You know, we got the prison overcrowding. They become corporatized. We got wars for profit. You know, it's the same thing. They don't want to get out of there. They're making too much money. So I'm thinking, is there a way that we can, you know, through your voice and others, you know, kind of rally the troops and get people to start thinking of, you know, identify all these as pointing out a problem in the corporate structure?
Yes. I wrote a book about this, an entire book called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and then referenced it heavily in a couple of other books that I've written, We the People and I Think What Would Jefferson Do? And here's the bottom line. Prior to 1886, the corporations in the United States were very rare. There were, you know, up until the time of the Civil War, there was never more than about 2,000 or 3,000 corporations in the entire country. Corporations were typically chartered to do single projects, and they were short-lived. For example, the Erie Canal Corporation was created to dig the Erie Canal. Banks were chartered as corporations, but you know they were few and far between. And every state, and in fact, the founders were so wary of the corporate structure that there was a debate about whether corporations should be regulated in the Constitution, and they decided to not mention the word corporation in the Constitution because they wanted to keep it at the state level so that people in individual states could keep a close and an eagle eye out on corporations. Every state in the Union up until 1886 had laws on the books that said that it was illegal for a corporation to live longer than a human lifespan. It varied from state to state. It was either 20, 30, or 40 years in every state in the Union. And so what that meant was that at the end of 40 years, a corporation had to do the equivalent of going through probate. It had to dissolve and reincorporate, and everything was taxed. This was to prevent multi-generational wealth from being hidden in the corporate form and to prevent dynasties from emerging. This was prior to 1886. It was illegal for a corporation to own stock in other corporations. It was illegal for a corporation to do more than one thing. If you wanted to build railroad cars and you also wanted to own a fast food joint, you had to have two separate corporations to do that.
And how would you recommend getting back to that?
Well, here's the problem. Here's what happened in 1886. And there were a whole bunch of other controls. Corporations had to have as the first sentence in their corporate charter their purpose for incorporating. Their first purpose had to be to serve the public good. Their second purpose was to do so by building railroad cars and making a profit. And every year in every state, the Secretary of State of every state in the Union had to examine the books. The books of the corporations had to be public and open, and they had to, or at least to the state, and they had to examine the books, and if they determined that the corporation was not operating in the public interest, they shut it down. And there were thousands of corporations up until 1886 that were shut down on a regular basis, literally given the corporate death sentence. What happened in 1886 was that the Supreme Court, in a case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the railroads argued before the Supreme Court that the 14th Amendment, which had been passed in the 1870s during Reconstruction as part of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that were put into the Constitution to take slavery out of the Constitution after the Civil War. The 14th Amendment says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. That's the exact language, no person. And the problem is that at law, for hundreds of years, British common law, American common law, and American contemporary law, there is no singular word person. There are corporate persons, or what are referred to as artificial persons, which actually includes governments, and there are what are referred to as natural persons, which is you and me, human beings. And the reason why a state or a corporation had to have some sort of personhood is so that they could have status at law, so that they could sue or be sued, and they could pay taxes. And so the railroads argued before the Supreme Court that because the 14th Amendment didn't say no natural person shall be denied equal protection under the law. And keep in mind, the 14th Amendment was put into place so to say that African Americans can't be denied equal protection under the law along with white folks. But the railroads argued that because it didn't say no natural person, it simply said no person, that as a corporate person, as an artificial person, they were covered under the 14th Amendment, and they should have the same rights against discrimination that everybody, that individuals do. Now, in that case, the Supreme Court actually ruled against them. But the guy who was John Chandler Bancroft Davis was his name. He was the son of the former governor of Massachusetts, a wealthy aristocrat, the former president of the Baltimore and New York Railroad. He was the clerk of the Supreme Court, and when in the year and a half between the time that the Supreme Court had that ruling and the Chief Justice who ruled against the railroads died, this guy, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, in the head note to the ruling, and you can read this.
Could you say his name slow, please?
Pardon?
Could you say his name slow, please?
John Chandler Bancroft Davis.
Thank you.
And this is all in my book, Unequal Protection. And, in fact, it used to all be on my website, tomhartmann.com. I think if you go to athenwood.com, you can find, which is our old website, you can find all the, you know, I've got actually a photograph. We found in the National Archives a letter from the Chief Justice to Davis saying, I did not say that. But in any case, after the Chief Justice died, Davis wrote into the headnote, which is a commentary that has no legal standing, that the Supreme Court had ruled that corporations have rights as persons under the law. And 34 times now since then, the Supreme Court has referenced that, which has made it law. And so corporations now have claimed First Amendment rights to lie. They've claimed Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. They've claimed Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. And they've claimed 14th Amendment rights against discrimination, saying if you can't, you know, kick a black person out of a diner, you can't keep a Walmart out of a neighborhood. All of these things, in my opinion, are specious. There's a huge movement in the United States to deny corporate personhood, which is what I'm talking about,
right,
to strip personhood from corporations. And if you Google corporate personhood, you'll find that there's some great groups working on this, and a lot of people. There have been resolutions in communities all over the country. There are over 100 communities in the state of Pennsylvania that have actually made corporate personhood illegal. There's CELDEF, CELDEF.org. It has a great website on it, a lot of good information. But, Rob, that's where it all started, and that's how it got as bad as it is. And the Federalist Society, the right-wing lawyer cranks, are gung-ho for corporate personhood. They love it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
Welcome back to Talk Radio for the Sane Among Us. Tom Hartmann here with you, and our weekly advertiser segment. This is where we let folks know, particularly if you own a business and you're thinking of advertising in your local, on your local station, in your local community radio, one of the most effective ways on earth to reach advertisers. Let folks know about some advertising success stories. We invite advertisers who are advertising on our local affiliates to come on, give them 1 minute to talk about their product, and 60 seconds to talk about what kind of success story they had, how it worked out for them advertising on their local station, just to showcase what's going on. And Deborah Leidig is with us. She is with the Norton's USA. She's the owner of Norton's USA. Their website is Norton's USA.com, Norton's USA.com. And Deborah, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Tom.
And tell us about your business.
Well, my business is a brick-and-mortar, a retail store selling only products that are made in the United States. I got the idea about 5 years ago after actually being in a play, playing Barbara Ehrenreich in Nickel and Dimed here in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And with that research, I realized what was happening with this race to the bottom, and I was getting pretty angry, and my husband said, you got to do something to turn this around. So I thought, okay, I'm going to open a store, highlight the manufacturers that have stayed in this country and worked really hard to do that.
That is absolutely great. So this is a local business in the Chicago area.
The local business, right, just 3 blocks out of downtown Barrington, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
It's a real general store. We have ice cream, candy, clothing, tools, light bulbs, toys, paper products, china, glassware, housewares.
You are the anti-Walmart. That's great. I love
totally
it.
Totally the anti-Walmart.
I love it. So, Deborah, you've been advertising on Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT, and the other now repeater stations that they have as well around the Chicago area.
Exactly.
How has that worked out for you?
It's been fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. The first day after my first commercial came on, the store was full of people. My recorder had messages from people thanking me for advertising. Well, I never had worked retail, and so I know now that the only way you make money is to get people in the door.
Sure.
And people have come from far and wide because of the advertising on WCPT. Indiana, way south in Illinois, Wisconsin, just to buy USA-made products and to support me and support the radio and everything else.
That is so great. That
it
is
really
so great.
Is. It was amazing.
Well, Deborah, thank you for sharing your story with us, and thanks for advertising on WCPT on Chicago's Progressive Talk and your website, NortonsUSA.com. Do you sell through the web, or is that?
No, we don't. Right now, okay. I'm working 24/7, just running this business,
okay.
But maybe
so,
in the future.
So people, please don't bury Deborah with emails. But if you're in the Chicago area, show up and buy something.
Please come by.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Deborah, thank you very much.
It's you're very welcome.
Great having you on, and great job that you're doing.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above and a thing called love.
Well, that's the wrong bumper, I think, but our geeky science alert. Oh, the birds and the bees. That is our geeky science alert. Now I get it. Birds and bees, of course. Well, here. You can't keep a good fish small. This is our segment for the week where we just, I share with you my favorite science stories from the week because I am a science geek, self-professed and proud of it. And fishermen and women like to catch big fish. And over time, we're seeing evolution at work, actually. Over time, what has happened is that the fish that of the same species that grow more slowly are starting to proliferate. The fish that grow more rapidly are being weeded out of the gene pool, the gene for how big a fish gets. And this has caused a lot of people, a lot of biologists and fisheryologists, whatever they are, ichthyologists, to be very concerned about this. And so they've done a study to find out if it's possible to reverse this. This was done at Stony Brook University in New York State. David Conover, marine ecologist, did it. And what they found was, as the bigger, faster-growing fish were removed from the population, those with the genetically slower growth rates grew to dominate. They tried to reverse it by turning back to to see if they could reverse the process. Turning back to the shrunken silver size, this was the fish they were using. His team removed 90% of the fish from each generation. Okay, just let's reverse the process. Let's create another bottleneck, as it's referred to Stephen Jay Gould's notion of punctuated evolution. Over 6 generations, the fifth fish regained 50% of their length. So it is possible to reverse some of the evolutionary damage that we're doing. That's good news. Here's another one. Researchers have long known that chimpanzees poke sticks through termites' nests to collect their dinner. They use tools. Now, some innovative chimps in the Republic of Congo have recently developed a new innovation on this. They fray the end of the sticks with their teeth to make it look kind of like a broom, so that the ends just feather out. And actually, the scientists don't know how it works, but when they stick these sticks into the termite's nest and pull it out, it has a whole lot more termites on it than the other sticks. And so that's kind of cool. Speaking of termites and ants, the Sahara Desert may be short on landmarks, but it's a patchwork of odors. This from the AAAS newsletter, Science Shots. Cracks in the soil, bits of wood, and shrubs all release specific scents, and desert ants use these smells to zero in on their tiny nest entrance. The problem, you know, researchers used to think they use visual cues, but the problem is the desert's constantly moving. So that's an interesting one. Here's one that I found interesting. Americans will shell out for their pets. This was a study done of 3,000 cat, dog, and bird owners. First of all, keep in mind, only 2% of smokers have ever attempted to quit for their children's health. Or at least that's according to a nationwide survey that was done in 2008. 30%, however, say they will quit if it's good for their pet's health. I think that's talk. We'll see. Talking about quitting is a whole lot easier than doing it. Can fish hear? They actually have ear parts inside their heads. They don't have external ears, but they pick up the sounds through their bodies. Interestingly enough, human ears evolved from fish gills, and so we apparently share some common ancestor. In fact, a fish also senses movement in the water with lateral lines run down each side of its body. Sharks, which are fish, have a keen ability to sense electricity. Oddly, the genes that contribute to this ability are responsible for the head and facial features in humans, linking sharks and humans to a common ancestor way back in time. So where's that missing evolutionary link? Maybe it's that guy. What's his name? Rick Santelli from CNBC? He's the missing link between sharks and humans, right?
Yeah, we don't need no stinking bailout for the homeowners. Just keep giving billions of dollars to Wall Street.
Yeah, good one, Rick. Good one. Back with your calls on Anything Goes Friday. Stick around, Tom Hartman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. CNBC is responding. Oh, man. John Stewart, if you watch The Daily Show, I'm a Daily Show junkie, I confess. If you watch The Daily Show with John Stewart, he just took CNBC apart. Rick Santelli, this guy who is like, hey, let's have a Tea Party revolt. And you know, Jim Cramer and the whole bunch of them just took them apart. And so they're commenting. They're trying to push back. I don't think it's going to work. I just don't think it's going to work. But it's interesting. Senator DeMint, Jim DeMint, the Republican from South Carolina, longtime cheerleader for school vouchers, once again putting his foot in his mouth. Chances are D.C. public school students will end up in a gang, he says. Oh, man. Michael Steele is saying, not me, baby, not happening, when people are saying, hey, people within his own party, Republicans, are saying, maybe you should resign. And SEIU laborers, people who work for a living, who are members of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, coming under attack from Billo the Clown, as Keith Olbermann so correctly, in my opinion, calls him. And they're pushing back, but he's calling them far-left extremists. Well, you know, I guess if you make millions of dollars a year as a talking head for Fox and your job is to defend the interests of the millionaires and billionaires, and by the way, I have no problem with somebody making a few million bucks a year. Not that I do, I don't. But I have no problem with that, provided that we pay or they pay a reasonable tax rate. But shilling for the interests of the big transnational corporations and working against the interests of working people in this country, it's just kind of sad. And that's basically the bottom line of Billo the Clown's show, which, by the way, we regularly beat in radio ratings all around the country proudly. James in Tacoma, back to Anything Goes Friday. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. This is James from Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'd like to thank you for being there, and happy birthday to Louise.
There you go. Thank you.
Not a problem. Hey, I was had a couple short questions and a request that would probably have to go off air, but isn't subversion from within to include a private army treason? And two, who was George Jr. speaking to when he was referring to his base?
Well, he said the haves and the have-mores is the famous quote. He was talking to a group of very, very wealthy donors. He says, look at you all here, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base. That was Bush Jr.'s comment. As to the private military, it is not illegal to create a private security service. I mean, this has been decided, actually, by the Supreme Court in I believe, around Pinkerton back in the late 19th century, but you know, it's not illegal to have private armed militias. It's not illegal to have, you know, I mean, the Michigan militia is quite well known. This is just a, you know, a bunch of citizens who get together and they're armed and they go out for target practice and things. The question of whether, I'm assuming you're getting into the area of, is Blackwater stepping over the line by creating a basically a military force for rent to any country anywhere in the world and using the United States as the base to do it? Was that the basis of your question?
Correct.
Yeah. I suspect that they're doing it legally. And but you know, I just find it creepy that we have and thanks for the call, James, that we have in the United States companies who are in the business of creating private militaries for hire. It's just a creepy business. I don't think it's a good one. Jennifer in Tacoma. Hey, Jennifer, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling about the discussion you had earlier with Bernie Sanders about infrastructure in our country and the way that it's affecting our schools.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy enough to talk about raising taxes and statistics and facts and figures, but I think it's another thing to see how it actually physically affects the kids who have to go to some of our schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some pictures up of some schools in my community, and I wondered if it'd be all right to give out that URL.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, it's www.tacomamama, that's TacomaMama.com.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's a really an illustration of what happens when you place caps on property taxes,
yep.
when you don't have a state income tax, when yep. you don't invest in the future.
Yeah, and Washington State, in many ways, is a very progressive state. You got two great senators. You've got a good governor, very
right.
good governor, and yet there's a strong contingent of wealthy right wing cranks in the state of Washington who want to keep it with a two-legged stool and
right.
who want to prevent anything that might serve the commons, the average person, and the commons in general. You know, keep that out of the functions of government, and just make sure that the government is there to protect their wealth. Well said, Jennifer, and well done. Good on you. Thank you very much, Tim in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was curious about on the housing crisis, and there were people that had variable rates, but for some reason they couldn't lock them in. Do you know if that was because of like points and closing costs and stuff like that?
No, there were mortgages sold, the adjustable rate mortgages, ARM mortgages, where it was explicit in the mortgage document that at the end of a year, the end of 2 years, the end of 3 years, 5 years, whatever, very different periods of time for different people and different companies, that the mortgage rate could go up, in some cases by a specified amount, in some cases by the rate of inflation or the CPI or the prime or whatever, plus a certain number of points. And the way that these were, the reason that some people signed up for these was because they were told, don't worry, yes, this thing is going to go from a 4% rate up to a 12% rate, or from a 4% rate up to an 8% or 9% rate 4 years from now. But 4 years from now, your house will be worth so much more, you'll be able to refinance all over again. And thus, they were basically keeping people in bondage to the banks forever, because as long as they can keep a mortgage in the first 4 or 5 years of that mortgage, almost 100% of your payments are interest, particularly if it's a 30-year note. So it was, you know, great for the banks, and it kept interest rates, it kept payments low. And this is where I think that the tax deduction for home mortgage interest, uniquely for home mortgage interest, has so distorted our economic system in the United States. I think we really need to rethink this. Renters don't get a deduction like this. Either it should be, you know, right across the board, you can deduct the cost of your housing from your income before you pay income taxes, or some, you know, factor, some percentage of your income or some number per person, like you can deduct, you know, a couple thousand bucks for every child you have. you can deduct a certain amount for housing. Or we should just abandon that, because that's how it's been set up, Jim. But that's what happened. Let's see here. Tony in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Glad I finally got you.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'm originally from New York, but I'm a snowbird, and I come down here, and I listen to your show as I'm driving around sometimes around here. And I, first of all, want to congratulate you for stressing the importance of manufacturing and the wealth of a nation, and you compared wealth, the difference between wealth and money. I never heard it put like that before, but you're the first radio announcer that I've heard stress the importance of manufacturing and production.
Yeah, I you know, it boggles my mind that nobody else is talking about it, and B, I think, frankly, most other people don't even understand it. Somebody sent me an email the other day, maybe it was you, who said two guys are in...
Wouldn't be me.
Okay, well, let me just give you this quick metaphor. You're going to love it, Tony. Yeah. He says, there's two guys in a sinking boat out at sea. One has $1 million. The other has a life preserver. Who has the wealth?
Oh, jeez.
It's a great metaphor, isn't it? Great story.
I like it. I love it. Well, like I say, I have to congratulate you because you're the first radio announcer to bring this point across. Now, I have a reason why I say this, too, because I'm a former industrial arts teacher, you know, technology education.
Sure.
I taught school for 33 years at a high school. I taught all areas. I taught math, too, but I taught all areas of industrial arts just about. And they call it technology education, too. Now, today, people have gone... really become illiterate with regards to what technology is. Some of them, it's the science of doing, is what Webster defines it as. Some people think that punching a keyboard, you know, on a computer is technology. That's communication, for crying out loud.
Yep.
You know, and I just can't understand people. But anyways, so I congratulate you for talking positively and stressing something that I've been doing for years to no avail. I've been retired now for several years.
Mm-hmm.
I want to correct you on something.
Okay. You got about a half a minute here, too.
Yeah, I don't need too much time here. You said it all started with Reagan. And by the way, I'm not Republican or Democratic. I don't want to...
Well, actually, a lot of it started with Jimmy Carter. He jumped on the deregulation bandwagon.
If we go back, when I went through college in 1967, I took the last textiles course. Textiles was one of the nine areas taught in industrial arts colleges. That's a state university college.
That's interesting.
In Buffalo. I was the last one, the last class.
Yeah, that's when everybody was starting to buy into the, you know, the computers are going to save us, robots are going to do everything.
1967. And we asked why, and they said, well, they dropped the class. They dropped textiles.
Yeah, I got it. Tony, thanks a lot for the call. I'm sorry we just slammed right into the break here. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your calls here, Anything Goes Friday, but first, our weekly labor segment sponsored by UnionJobs.com, putting people to work in union jobs since 1997. That's UnionJobs.com. Deborah Berger is with us. She's a registered nurse and the co-president of the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee. That is NNOC.net and CalNurses.org. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on today.
It's a pleasure to have you on. And tell us about this new registered nurses union that's being formed.
It is basically a melding of three different RN organizations to form one national nurses union, which will represent over 150,000 registered nurses nationally from Georgia to California.
That's absolutely great. Why should the average person care whether nurses are unionized?
Well, the average person, the average patient on the street, when they go into a hospital and need care, need to have a nurse that can feel free to speak up about unsafe practices in the hospital or in a clinic setting, anywhere that nursing care is provided, and know that that nurse can speak up and make sure that the patient is taken care of and gets the care they need and report unsafe care situations without fear of reprisal from their employer. We have whistleblower protections, but by the time a nurse is either fired or disciplined for reporting an unsafe situation, they have often lost their job and had to move out of the community. So we're making it safer for patients to get care.
What impact is the creation of this new national nurses union, essentially, going to have on the labor movement?
Historically, what happened was we had a parent group called the American Nurses Association that essentially was funded by corporations. So they did the will of the whatever the corporation wanted to put forward.
So it's
forward.
Kind of a faux union.
A faux union. Yeah. And historically, there have been individual state unions that have spoken for nurses in the individual states. And so there wasn't a way to have access to a national forum in a nurse's setting. So what we did when we formed this National Nurses Union was change the focus from the local level to the national level so that we can put pressure on our government to make sure that there is a national health care system that works for everyone, the single payer or Medicare for all, and make sure that there are the best patient protections and nursing protections in this country.
That's great. You know, Terry Mills here in Portland has been a champion of the national nurse, having in addition to a surgeon general, a national nurse. Any thoughts on that?
Well, we've had a difference of opinion on that. We have looked at that in a number of ways to try and see if we could support that. The problem is that it becomes so politically charged. If you look at the website of the Surgeon General when President Bush was in charge, if you looked at the Surgeon General website when Clinton or Obama's in charge, the view of how health care and medical care is practiced changes based on who's in charge in each administration. And we felt that it was important to keep our voice unconnected to politics in that manner.
So you're sticking to your knitting, as it were.
Yeah.
You're sticking to nursing. Why just unionize registered nurses? Why not all hospital workers, bring all hospital workers under a single union?
Well, in an ideal world, that could work. You know, the Wobblies, you know, the IWW.
The industrial workers of the world.
Yeah. that could work. But the reality is that nurses are in a unique profession that needs to be able to advocate for the patient without looking at all of the other biases that you bring in when you represent other classifications of healthcare workers and professionals. And so we felt that it was important to have a nursing voice and that perspective. And that's not to say that we don't support other healthcare workers and their unions, but that our issues are unique. Mm-hmm. And we feel that we need to be able to move forward on those issues without having to worry about other professions, other classifications of healthcare workers.
Yeah, very good, very good. We've been talking with Deborah Berger. She is the co-president of the California Nurses Association, the National Nurses Organizing Committee, NNOC.net, and calnurses.org. And this is our weekly labor segment sponsored by UnionJobs.com, putting people to work for unions since 1997, UnionJobs.com. Deborah, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Okay, thank you.
And keep up the great work. It is so good to know that we're all going to be a little safer in the hospital as a consequence of the great work you're doing. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Great talking with you. We'll be back with Governor Don Siegelman, and then back to your calls in just a moment. Let's check in with the governor first and see what's up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Welcome back to Talk Radio for the Rest of Us, the place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Governor Don Siegelman is with us, donsiegelman.com, his website. Governor, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much. Glad to be with you today.
I am glad to hear your voice. I understand you just lost your appeal, and I was a little concerned that they may snatch you away like they did in the beginning. Tell us what happened.
I thought made a very strong and convincing argument to a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit. They ruled against us, and of course I am disappointed, but not disillusioned or not discouraged. And we will continue the fight, and we will win in the end. I don't know how long the end is, but we're going to win in the end.
Right? Is there a higher court that you can take this to?
We will. My lawyers are looking at the options, and one of them is to ask the 11th Circuit, the entire 11th Circuit, to hear our case,
right.
which we think we will do. It was heard by a three-judge panel, and we would like for it to be heard now by the other eight, I believe it is, remaining judges.
Were those three judges by any chance George W. Bush appointees, or do you think that there's anything political in this, or was it just the technicalities?
I can't get into the legal of it.
Yeah, I
understand. Yeah, I don't want to get into the legal and political stuff regard to the court, but I can get into the legal and political stuff with regard to Karl Rove.
Yes, well, let's start there. In fact, let's just start at the beginning. If you'd give the backstory to this to our listeners, because I know we've picked up a few radio stations since the first time. It seems like it was a year ago or so that we began really, talking with you frequently about this and pushing this story.
It was about a year ago when you and I first started, and I think we stayed on the phone about an hour that day.
Yep. So let's recap it real quickly. What happened here?
Well, recapping quickly, I was right after I endorsed Al Gore for president. I was first governor to endorse him in 1999. An investigation was started against me by the attorney general, who was Karl Rove's client. Later, that investigation was kicked into high gear by the U.S. attorney appointed by George W. Bush, whose husband is the closest political and personal friend to Karl Rove. His name is Bill Canary. Canary served as chief of staff of the NRC, ran the ground troops for the 92 Bush-Quayle campaign, and is described by the chairman of the Republican Party as a political paratrooper, somebody that we drop into places where we need something fixed. Well, it was his wife that started the federal investigation and brought me to trial 1 month before the Democratic primary. It was, we have, of course, learned that Karl Rove's partner and one of Jack Abramoff's employees were involved in stealing my 2002 election And we've since learned that Jack Abramoff, who's Karl Rove's bagman, put in $13 million through Ralph Reed into Alabama to defeat me beginning in 1998 and again in 2002. I have been, I attracted their attention because I have had a number of different political battles with Karl Rove going back over 14 years now, 15 years. And Rove came to Alabama in 1992. He and the husband of my prosecutor came from Texas to Alabama, married girls in Alabama, and Karl Rove built his home on the Gulf Coast and started running campaigns out of Alabama beginning in 1994. And we have crossed swords ever since. I think I drew his attention when I started putting out feelers about running for national office, entering some Democratic primaries in the 2003-2004 cycle. But regardless, that's pretty much the story. I was prosecuted by the wife of my opponent's campaign manager, who's a close friend of Karl Rove, who's the U.S. attorney, and I was brought to trial 1 month before the Democratic primary. I was convicted of something that the New York Times has repeatedly said has never been a crime in America, and that is appointing a campaign contributor to an all-volunteer board. And in this case, the person I appointed had served on that board for 12 years through three previous governors. The only
Republican governors, in fact.
Two Republican governors, yeah. One Democratic governor. Yeah. But the only testimony that they could come up with to convict me of this charge was the testimony of a felon who was plea bargaining from 40 years down to no years, told 60 Minutes when they did a show on me in February of last year, that he had to change his testimony 70 different times in order to get it right with the prosecutors before they would let him go on the stand.
Wow. It boggles the mind that with that thin a case that you wouldn't win on appeal. I know you were expecting to win on appeal.
Well, I was. Yeah, we also had 54 former state attorneys generals from all over the country, 54 Democratic and Republican attorneys general, who weighed in on my behalf and filed a friend of the court brief with the 11th Circuit saying that what I'd been charged with was not a crime.
Right.
And but the 11th Circuit disagreed, and so now we have to fight on from there.
Right. I saw John Conyers. You know, Karl Rove has now agreed not to testify before an open committee as a normal human being would, but apparently he's going to do it the way that the royalty in this country does. Apparently he thinks he's the royalty.
He's sure being treated that way.
Yeah, you know, not under oath and special deposition and all this kind of stuff.
Behind closed doors with as many lawyers as he wants in the room who can object to questions. And apparently he's not even being put under oath.
That's correct. Although I did, and I read John Conyers' statement about this, and Conyers said, and, you know, good on John Conyers for pushing and at least, you know, taking the testimony.
I'm a big supporter of John Conyers.
Yeah, but he, in his public statement about it, he said, I look forward to getting to the bottom of the attorney, you know, the firing of these nine U.S. attorneys. He never mentioned your case. Do you think that your case not coming up might have been part of the deal that he cut with Karl Rove?
I don't think so. I'd be shocked if that were the case. I feel so good about John Conyers and his commitment to the truth. I know that his focus is on Karl Rove, and there's no question that, you know, when you look at the big picture, the important thing is that we restore justice in this country and that we protect and preserve our democracy. And To get there, we have to discover all of the wrongs that Karl Rove was responsible for. And whether it's leading us into a war under false pretenses, or using illegal wiretaps or torture to extract statements from people, or whether it's stealing elections or using the Department of Justice as a political weapon, the American people have got to know the truth. This is a deep a deep infection that has gone through our Department of Justice and through our Department of Defense and through other departments in this country, and we've got to get this infection out of our body politic, and that starts with bringing Karl Rove to the table and extracting the truth out of him. I would, while I'm praising John Conyers, I'm also admonishing the committee that this will not be easy. Don't expect it to come fast. It won't be pretty, and the American people will not be proud of what they see if the full truth comes out. But it's got to come out for this country to be healed, for the people of this country to have faith in their justice system, in their justice department, and in their government again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think is the fate and future of Karl Rove at this point? I mean, he seems like he's talking about how the Democrats want to fillet him and all this kind of stuff. I mean, this is a guy who committed, in my opinion, some serious crimes against the Constitution and against the people of the United States, not to mention against you.
Well, I think, Tom, I know you picked up on this, but just reading his statement, he is trying to lay the foundation that this is politics as usual. He made the comment that the FBI bill or the Justice Department bears the name of the campaign manager of the Democratic president, Robert F. Kennedy. Well, he was also the Attorney General of the United States. He was also assassinated. He's tried to blur the lines by saying that it's normal for people in the White House to talk about who is the proper person to appoint to a U.S. attorney. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about firing Republicans because they would not pursue cases that would be beneficial to the election of Republicans. We're talking about instituting prosecutions against Democrats for the simple reason of trying to win elections or to gain power. And those are serious crimes against our country.
Yeah. Amen. Governor Don Siegelman, you have to check out his website, donsiegelman.com. Governor, good luck.
Hey, I need some. Thank you.
Yeah, and let me encourage all my listeners to get over to your website and toss in a little help your way.
I look forward to getting back with you. There's some more we need to talk about.
Okay, good. We'll talk again soon. Governor Don Siegelman, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Special thanks so much to Louise Hartman. Happy birthday, Louise. To my producer, Sean Taylor. To Mike Oakes, Chris Weiss, and Kurt Brown, our engineering support. To Derek Alderman and Sean for video production. To our webmaster, George Vassilopoulos. Ron Hartenbaum of WID. All of Tom's Angels, yes, they call themselves that, the folks at Dial Global, Amy, Jessica, Ramona, and Donna. To Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room. To our affiliates, our sponsors. And to you for listening to our program. Plus, a special thanks to Mike Dirks at KPOJ, AM 620 KPOJ here in Portland, our flagship station. Thank you. Victoria Jones is going to be with us in just a moment from Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. But first, Paul from Sweden calling in on our international line. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, my name's Fred. How are you doing, Tom?
Oh, I'm sorry, Fred.
That's quite all right. I just wanted to call. You were talking about Karl Rove, and Amy Goodman did a piece in Common Dreams a couple months ago, I guess. She said that Karl Rove has been hired by the Reinfeld administration or the Reinfeld campaign to be a campaign consultant here in Sweden for them for their next election.
Hmm.
Isn't that awful?
Yeah, it is. It is, and I'm not surprised. In fact, some of the Democratic strategists have been hired by some pretty dicey administrations in South America. I mean, just all, you know, all around and all in general, it's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Fred, thanks a lot for the tip on that. Bummer. Victoria Jones, TalkReadyNews.com. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Hey, Tom. Well, some of it, I'm sure you've already heard that the unemployment rate has gone up to 8.1%, the highest rate since 1983. And the omnibus spending bill got stuck and stalled. They've passed a stopgap measure so that the government will keep functioning. Those of us here in Washington, D.C., of course, are very happy about that. Keep functioning until Tuesday. Now, a couple of Democrats who stalled it, Senators Robert Menendez and Bill Nelson, stalled it because of the provision inserted by the House to loosen travel and importation restrictions in Cuba. This has kind of embarrassed the White House, and they're talking to them to try and loosen this up, and it looks as though they may have a deal. So that's going to make a difference. So that's going to make a difference on that. On the intelligence front, I don't know whether you saw the interview with John Yoo in the Orange County Register.
I did not.
He's normally very reticent. He never comments on any of the stories about him. And it was a wide-ranging interview. What have you got on your iPod? Where do you work out? Things like that. But he was asked, is there anything you would have done differently about the memos? And he said that they lack a certain polish. but he said, yeah, I thought that was interesting. He said, I don't think I would have made the basic decisions differently. But I thought the most interesting sentence in the entire thing, and he was asked, is it normal practice to give just a straight opinion? And he said, your client, the president, or your client, the justice, your client, the senator, needs to know what's legal and not legal. Then he said this, and sometimes what's legal and not legal is not the same thing as what you can do or what you should do.
Oh, that's bizarre.
I think that's a very interesting
thing. You know, the Republicans have, and conservatives in general, have made a career out of condemning moral relativism. I think that's what you just heard.
Yes, I think so, too. I think it's a fascinating statement, and it's getting no publicity.
Yeah. Huh. Well, thank you for sharing that with us.
I'm delighted to do so. Yeah. Meantime, also on the intelligence front, the Senate Intelligence Committee reached a bipartisan agreement yesterday on the framework of what's going to be a wide-ranging review of the CIA's past treatment of terrorism detainees. Mm. Now, most of the work's going to be conducted in secret, so we just have to hope for leaks, because they just conduct just about everything in secret, as you know.
Yeah.
But they did settle on a blueprint for a year-long probe that's going to look into detention and interrogation of about 100 suspected al-Qaeda operatives.
Yeah, I think this idea that was floated last night on Keith Olbermann's show, Countdown, that for at least 7 of the last 8 years, by virtue of the U memos and other, you know, memos and positions taken by Gonzalez as Attorney General and others, the United States was a dictatorship. And fortunately for all of us, they flexed their muscles. The executive branch of the federal government flexed those dictator muscles in only small ways, you know, going after Jose Padilla, for example, in ways that, in my opinion, are just absolutely criminal and a total violation of the Constitution. And a few other people, they didn't go after, you know, thousands like Pinochet did, or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands the way that Franco did, or that Mussolini did, or millions the way that Hitler did and Stalin did. But this was we were a dictatorship, and we have now stepped back from that god-awful edge. And Americans really need to consider seriously for, you know, a moment, you know, how close we came and what that could have meant had, for example, John McCain become president and simply extended those policies.
It's quite extraordinary.
It is.
The most bizarre story of the day is a new report about Veterans Affairs Department employees. I don't know if you've heard about this. Squirreling away tens of thousands of unopened letters relating to benefits claims. Apparently, they just don't open the mail. 16,000 pieces of unprocessed mail from Detroit.
Oh,
over 700 pieces of unopened mail in New York. They just don't open the mail. And they also shred mail.
Yeah.
And then they changed the date on mail.
Yeah, our friend Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, mentioned the latter two things on our program, I think it was yesterday. This apparently with Shinseki now in charge of the Veterans Administration, a lot of this stuff is going to change because we had, you know, the VA was being run the same way that that FEMA was being run and every other federal agency was being run during the Bush administration of, you know, well, the government can't do anything right, so let's not fund it, let's not support it, let's not help them out, and et cetera. So hopefully things will get better in the VA.
That's certainly the hope. Meantime, Hillary Clinton is talking, giving interviews, and saying that there is a sense of urgency within the Obama administration to take on many international issues at once.
Well, that's good. That's what we need. I'm glad to hear that. Victoria Jones, thank you, Victoria, for dropping by.
Thank you very much.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Coming up Monday, I'll challenge Carrie Lucas of the Independent Women's Forum, who says, Rush doesn't need to win women, but conservatives do. Yeah, good luck with that, Carrie. Plus, here's a brand new union for registered nurses. Well, actually, we talked about that today. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.